Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme and senior research fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Anupama Sen, who's senior research fellow at the Electricity Research Programme at the Institute, and Carlo Napoli, who's senior researcher at the NL Foundation. And they're here today to discuss the key messages from their paper, Beyond Energy, Incentivizing Decarbonization Through the Circular Economy, that was recently published by the OIES. Anupama and Carlo, great to have you here. Welcome to the OIES podcast. Now, to start with, can I come to you, Anupama? And for the listeners of the podcast, can we just define what is meant by the term circular economy?
Well, David, the circular economy as a concept is fundamentally based on closing the loops around systems of extraction, production, and consumption. So materials and products are kept within the loop for as long as possible, with leakages minimized or ideally eliminated. Now, the concept itself originally emerged around the late 1960s, and it's been studied from various viewpoints. And it was picked up by corporate sector organizations in the 1970s as a part of their management practices as well. But it basically involves the move from a linear form of organization and operation to a circular form through the implementation of various measures, which we discuss in the paper. So the term circular itself is not very well defined. The concept could be applied at various levels, at the level of organizations, at the level of economies, at the level of sectors. So, but in a nutshell, that's how one would define the circular economy.
Very circular. I like it. Yes. So, Carla, can I come to you then? Because in the paper, you say that the circular economy is a traditional concept in the economics of production and management of resources, and that it can be implemented widely at the organizational level. So perhaps I could ask you, could you elaborate on what that means?
Oh, well, David, if you happen to visit a factory, any factory, you will be surprised by the, I might say, obsessive care which is devoted to avoid wastes of resources, such as energy, for example, raw materials, and also human labor. Businesses, of course, tend to reduce their costs to a minimum by using as less resources as they can. And in this sense, a traditional notion of circular economy is widely used in the world. The problem is that cost functions that drive this optimization are usually determined according to a take-make-waste model, which doesn't take into account most of the negative externalities that are associated with the use of resources. Now, the concept of circular economy, of course, has evolved over time to include beyond efficiency and optimization the aim of sustainability. Today, the circular economy concept is therefore much more sophisticated, and essentially it aims at decoupling economic growth from the consumption of non-renewable resources. And, I must say, it is still far from being widespread.
So, Carlo, building on that, could you perhaps give us maybe one or two examples as to how the circular economy approaches are typically being applied and measured within organizations?
Well, as I said, modern circular economy is not as widespread as we would like it to be. One of the main reasons is there is no standard way to calculate a circularity score. That said, many proposals have been made, both as generical theoretical frameworks, like, for example, circle scan by circular economy or circulability by Azat Hanel, and also application type indexes like Circulytics by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and the Circular Transition Index published by the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. These approaches include a variety of metrics, including, for example, the share of renewable energy and secondary resources used, the circular flow of material, or the existence of circular models of use, such as product as a service or sharing services. All of these measurement services are, of course, valid and have their own merits. But again, there is no global standard. Harmonization at the international level is important to facilitate the development of the circular economy because it would allow to measure it in a clear, simple, and widely recognized way. And as we know, measuring is the first step for improvement.
Okay, well, then let's kind of step back to the paper itself for a minute, because as I said earlier, the title of the paper is prefixed with the words Beyond Energy. Now, I find that interesting, particularly because we are an Institute for Energy Studies. So, you know, Anupama, perhaps I could ask you first, you know, what do you mean by this phrase, beyond energy?
That's a great question, David. So in the paper, we talk about how the predominant approach of governments to decarbonization over the last two decades has included two primary areas of policy focus, which has been replacing fossil fuels with renewables in electricity generation and improving energy use efficiency. And these two measures combined have contributed the largest proportions of offsets to carbon emissions from economic growth in recent years. But we now see an acceleration of ambitions and targets to achieve net zero carbon by the middle of the century. And we argue that if we stick with the predominant approach, full decarbonization may not be achieved. There might be some sectors that might be left undecarbonized, such as hard-to-abate industry sectors like steel, cement, ethylene production, ammonia, etc. And moreover, one might argue that there are other ways to decarbonize rather than electrifying those sectors. But we also argue in the paper that there are technical and economic reasons why this is difficult, which involve things technically like changing the production processes of some of these industry sectors, which is also very costly. The economic reason would be that a lot of the products that are produced by these sectors compete in international markets. So if you have decarbonization and you don't have an economy-wide way of pricing in the cost of externalities, then those products could end up becoming uncompetitive on the international market. So because of all of these reasons and many others that we discuss in the paper, we asked ourselves the question, what other solutions beyond the predominant focus on energy production emissions could we then use to enhance decarbonization in order to meet these new ambitious zero carbon targets? And that is why we use the title Beyond Energy in the paper.
It's certainly quite a statement, may I say, Anupama. And you know, Carla, I'd like to come to you. Why do you think this approach, which goes beyond the focus on reducing emissions from energy production, you know, is really necessitated at this moment in time? What do you think?
Well, as Anupama already said, simply put, we just cannot reach net zero if we just focus on energy production. It's not enough. And first of all, because with this approach, the approach focused on just on energy production, we are missing a large chunk of emissions that are the emissions connected with the supply chain of products and also of services. And this causes, of course, the so-called carbon leakage mechanism. In other words, the current approach towards decarbonization just doesn't take into account the fact that the trade is globalized and the fact that goods are typically made and used in different places. Secondly, we are also missing the emissions that are associated with the so-called hard-to-abate sectors, which are not easily or practically decarbonized by the simple use of renewables. And it's not just about that. The issue is not just about greenhouse gas emissions. The challenge we are facing nowadays is much wider. It's rather about the overall impact of human activities on natural resources, including not only energy, but also raw materials, biodiversity, topsoil, freshwater, you name it. The good thing is that circular economy looks like just the silver bullet for this challenge, as it essentially aims at decoupling the economic growth from the consumption of natural resources. And it does so by closing the loops. And most importantly, in principle, it is a concept that can be applied to all sectors and above all, to the economy as a whole.
Now, of course, we are recording this podcast on the 22nd of April, Earth Day, and of course the day in which Joe Biden is going to be hosting the Earth Day Climate Summit, which President Xi is going to join. So I think it's very apt that we're having this very interesting discussion on this particular day. So Anupama, you know, in the paper, you discuss, you know, an alternative way of addressing emission reductions, which is to focus on life cycle emissions. How does this fit with the circular economy approach?
Well, David, as Carlo mentioned, the current predominant approach doesn't really take into consideration emissions from different parts of the supply chain. So, for instance, to give you an example, nuclear energy exhibits negligible emission levels at the stage of power generation. But then emissions do arise in other parts of the supply chain, like in the manufacturing of the components for plants, the transportation of those components and other materials, and also at the decommissioning stage. And the current approach, as Carlo mentioned, ignores international supply chains and focuses on emissions within national boundaries. Now, this is applicable to all energy generation technologies. And in contrast, circular economy approaches are based on life cycle analysis of greenhouse gas emissions, which accounts for all of the energy and material flows associated with the system or process. So it considers the entire supply chain of the energy carrier. Now, a key barrier here, as Carlo also referred to, is that the measurements of life cycle emissions are very difficult because there are no well-defined boundaries and there's no single and internationally harmonized method of measurement of these emissions. And many technologies also tend to be highly context-specific. So that is a barrier that needs to be worked on. And in the paper itself, we rely on estimates from the literature to show how life cycle emissions from various electricity generation technologies vary. What's obvious is that with the replacement of unabated fossil fuels with renewables in power generation, you get a large reduction in emissions. But then if you also decarbonize specific parts of the supply chain, such as the material fabrication stage, you might also get a secondary effect. So that's why we argue for circular economy as approaches as a way of enhancing decarbonization.
So let's now move to the practical applicability of circular economy approaches. Now, as you say in the paper, this is not a new concept, but has recently risen to the top of the agendas of many governments. So, Carlo, could I perhaps come to you? Could you give us maybe a few examples of how or in what context circular economy policies are actually being adopted?
Yes, I must say Europe is on the lead. So the obvious mention is the recent European Green Deal and the related new circular economy action plan, which are probably the most advanced pieces of legislation on the topic and set some important objectives on the transition to circular economy. However, I must say that the development of circular economy model across Europe also at legislative level is not homogeneous. Some countries, especially in Eastern Europe, are in an early phase of transition, and although moving fast, are still far from best performers, like, for example, Finland, which has established recently the first national roadmap towards circular economy. Many circular European countries still lack a national strategic roadmap. And most importantly, they lack a roadmap that considers circular economy like a game changer, a strategic game changer, rather than just another environmental sustainability tool. Moreover, most of the initiatives to promote circular economy have been, and often still are, not comprehensive at all, but rather focused on just one or a few sectors, or, for example, on just a chunk of the whole story, like, for example, waste management, which is too narrow a perspective. The issue here is not only that focusing on a sector, a single sector, you are adopting a partial approach, but most importantly is that being circular in a limited domain doesn't necessarily mean you're being circular from an economy-wide perspective. So you need an overall optimization of the economy. So to make this approach actually effective, we need a more comprehensive standpoint, ideally embracing the entire economy, or at least capable of covering entire supply chains and of cutting across sectors in a systematic and homogeneous way.
Interesting. So Anna Palmer, if I could come to you next, because you say that the paper that the circular economy approaches could be a strong complement to existing instruments of decarbonization. Now, does this hold in every context, do you think?
So this is related to what Carlo just said as well, that the circular economy has gained a lot of popularity and it's risen in the agendas of governments because of these accelerated decarbonization goals. And there are some studies which show that it can lead to economic benefits, but there are some fundamental discussions to be had over whether it leads to net economic as well as environmental benefits. So in the paper, we basically give some examples of areas where the circular economy approach, when adopted within a specific sector, could lead to some unintended consequences at the economy-wide level. So for instance, recycling cement would require energy inputs which are comparable to making new cement, or the energy that's used to separate critical materials that are used in compounds as part of the recycling process may be greater than the energy that's actually needed for virgin production. And although steel has one of the highest rates of recycling, up to 90% can be recycled, recycled steel contributes only around a third of current steel demand because of the higher rate of economic demand growth for steel. So our point here is that the effectiveness of circular economy-based approaches is very much limited by the sort of economic paradigm within which agents operate or sectors operate. And so you have to take that into account when basically implementing circular economy approaches, as Carlo also referred to.
So Anupam, if I could stay with you, what are the broad conditions under which the circular economy approaches can lead to net benefits in terms of government's decarbonisation and net zero objectives at the overall level? What's your view on that?
Well, if you go back to some of the original literature on the subject of circular economy, one of the conditions for achieving a circular economy is if the global demand for both the volume and the composition of products could be stabilized. Now, as we discuss in the paper, this is not achievable under a linear system of production and consumption. So we argue that there are some broad conditions for circular economy approaches to lead to net economic as well as environmental benefits. And we outline three main ones. The first one is if we can achieve the more intensive use of an existing stock of resources, ideally a reduced stock of resources. The second sort of broad condition is if we can develop secondary markets to aid circular flows. And the third broad condition is if they can put in place mechanisms or measures to prevent or mitigate unintended consequences, which we've just discussed in the previous section, which are also referred to as circular economy rebound effects. So in the paper, we argue that cohesive public policy frameworks are really necessary to create the kind of institutional conditions to incentivize circular economy and put in place these broad conditions.
Okay, so Carla, can I come to you now? Because isn't the economy-wide implementation of a circular economy approaches a bit of a tall order? So I expect my question is how achievable is the circularity that you speak of in broad terms? What do you think?
Yes, it may look a tall order, actually. But look, luckily, there are a couple of interesting aspects that we need to take into account. First of all, we don't need to implement our 100% circular economy system, which, by the way, it's impossible to be 100% circular. For example, Circle Economy just recently published an article stated that adding just a further 8.4% to the current 8.6% level of circularity of the world economy could, along with current emission reduction pledges, bring the world below a 2 degrees Celsius path by 2032. Second, for hard it may seem, circular economy has the great advantage of matching environmental and economic benefits. The Ellen MacArthur Foundation estimated that pursuing circular business models could help boost the economic growth in Europe by 7% by 2030, which is remarkable. And in a study that we at Ellen Foundation, together with the European House and Rosetti, have published last year, we've underlined the very relevant impact on circularity on GDP right now. So we calculate about 300 billion euros in terms of GDP in 2018, 2.4 million jobs, 90 to 110 billion investment, and a work productivity up to 1,000 euros per employee. These are big numbers. And considering that this is the level of impact of quite a small degree of implementation of circular economy, it is clear that the potential of this model is huge. So I can conclude that with a relatively small effort, we can obtain huge advantages. So in conclusion, yes, it is a tall order, but it is well worth the pain to pursue.
Absolutely. And the numbers you overviewed there, you know, Carlo, were immense. And even if we achieve part of those, you know, the global economy certainly needs that. But in your paper, you outline very helpfully in a table how the metrics that are used by organizations to initiate and implement circular economy approaches can be extended to sector-wide or economy-wide level within a wider public policy framework of incentives. Carlo, now, what are the fundamental elements of this framework of incentives?
Well, of course, moving from organization to economy-wide level, the game changes. But just to simplify things, there are essentially two categories of measure that can be taken. Market-based incentives, like, for example, carbon prices, and regulatory incentives, like technology standards, non-tradable performance standards, as such. But regardless of the type of policy signal that one may choose to adopt, because it's a choice whether to adopt one or another, A common thing is that an effective framework should ideally have a few key features. First of all, it must apply to the widest extent of the supply chain, and ideally to the entire supply chain. And this is essentially to avoid leakages. It must correctly price externalities, and this to avoid distortions and undesired effects. And finally, it must incentivize accurate and possibly cost-effective measurement of externalities and emissions, and subsequently verification and reporting. At the moment, no one has achieved a set of policy measures that are cohesive and comprehensive enough to incentivize, let's say, a full decarbonization in the economy. Rather, most systems look like, I might say, a patchwork of different measures rather than an organic one. Finally, another important aspect to take into account is that driving such an ambitious transition at the macro level would, of course, result in structural shifts, which will see winners and losers, inevitably, and at least a reallocation of capital and labor. For that reason, a suitable policy framework must take this into account and include mitigation mechanisms to assure a just transition.
So, Anupam, perhaps I can come to you perhaps with the same question to get your view. You know, what are the fundamental elements of the kind of framework of incentives that you overview in the paper?
Well, David, you very helpfully mentioned the table that we have in the paper, which kind of tries to synthesize all these various things. And that table includes, first of all, the key characteristics of a circular economy approach. So that would include things like efficiency, substitution, the increased intensity of use of goods and services, recycling, etc. And the table also includes a description of what each of these implies, the metrics that are used within organizations to implement and measure these various things. And then into this table, we try and map all of the different types of existing policy measures that could be used to encourage circularity in the global energy economy. And Carlo sort of discussed that we've categorized them into incentive mechanisms and regulatory incentives. And I'll just give you a couple of high-level examples from that table in the paper to explain what we mean. So if we were to try and encourage the increased intensity of use of goods and services and products, we'd be looking at a mixture of measures such as carbon labeling programs, depreciation accounting to retain the value of products for as long as possible in the economy, favorable VAT rates, and sort of other sort of fiscal policy type measures. And some countries have done this. The EU has a product environmental footprint methodology, for instance. France has a mobility orientation law, which has a package of fiscal and regulatory measures to catalyze things like shared mobility and mobility as a service in the automobile sector. But as Carlo mentioned, the drawback is that these are very sector-based and you need to account for the wider system. Perhaps just to give you one quick other example, if you wanted to incentivize recyclability, you'd put in place recycling standards, but you'd also have things like public procurement policies, which favor recycled products, let's say. And you'd accompany that with things like VAT rates, changes in depreciation accounting. An example would be in Sweden and Luxembourg, they apply lower VAT rates to the repair of certain goods in the economy to try and prolong their use. And all of these things then feed back into encouraging circularity and eventually reducing the amount of energy and the sort of the material resources that we extract in the current linear economic system.
I must say, I'm finding this discussion absolutely fascinating because it's not a subject I'm an expert on, but it's so much interesting material coming here. But we are getting now to near the end of the podcast. I always like to end up kind of a few more challenging questions. And Carl, I'd like to come to you on this one, if I may, you know, because over the last 20 minutes or so, we've discussed a lot of issues. And I expect, you know, our listeners, you know, want to know what the ultimate question is. Why haven't governments managed to do this before? And, you know, what are the main barriers? So, Carlo, perhaps you can give us your view on that.
Well, to the why we haven't thought about that before is, in my opinion, both a matter of urgency perception and of the size of the issue and the dilution of the effects. I must say that the issue has never been so pressing for the simple fact that the absolute amount of materials, goods, and services that we produce, exchange, and consume, or humanity consumes, has never been as large as today, and is growing. In a way, it is the first time humanity is facing such a problem at this scale. Now, of course, it's time to move forward and quickly. And nice thing is we have a powerful tool. Looking at the technical reason why we are at this point is that there is a very large, big barrier towards the implementation of circular economy, and it's the fact that almost the entire economy, and therefore the vast majority of laws, rules, regulations, standards, you name it, but also most of the business models and practices are essentially based on a linear view of the world. For example, regulation aims at enabling decarbonization through least cost methods, but they don't fully internalize the cost of externalities. This implies that technologies and the related supply chains are optimized to minimize the cost in predominantly take-make waste system. Exactly the same can be said about business models, which are predominantly based on this linear view. Just to explain that in a simple way, most of business models work on the assumption that you earn more by selling more stuff produced at the least possible cost, as calculated under the assumption of a linear system. This is, in a way, another way to say that externalities are not fully taken into account through the entire value chain. So the fact that the economic system is essentially still conceived as a linear one tends to imply a fundamental trade-off between economic wealth and sustainability behind every business and political choice. So this is a very big issue. In a world that instead is conceived to be circular, these trade-offs tend to be less stringent, to disappear, at least be less problematic.
Well, Anupam, why did I come to you with perhaps what is an obvious question? Because leaving aside governments and the operations of organizations, how do you ultimately get the consumer to change their approach and adopt behaviors that encourage, you know, a circular economy?
That's an excellent question, David, and perhaps one to which people don't have the answer yet. It's very difficult, really, to predict consumer behavior and expectations, because alternatives that are rational or optimal from an environmental and economic standpoint may not actually, be preferred by the consumer. And that could include, that could be due to many factors. It could be because if you do price in externalities generated from consumption, that could lead to higher upfront costs, which consumers don't like. If you do want to provide incentives to consumers to change their behavior, the types of incentives that consumers respond to are very different. So some consumers may prefer upfront incentives at the point of sale. Others may prefer future incentives. So there are various factors that influence that. And it's a very, very complex topic to really get into. But I could just give you the example of perhaps the transport sector, where you see as soon as you remove EV purchase incentives for consumers, you get a drop in electric vehicle EV sales. But moving beyond that and to the wider issue, again, sticking with the transport sector where we are trying to decarbonize through electrification, the whole electric vehicle supply chain is being designed around the linear paradigm, which is the personal passenger vehicle paradigm, which fits with the linear economy. Whereas in a circular economy, basically what it would involve is incentivizing consumers to utilize both the existing stock of electric vehicles as well as other shared decarbonized transport options to full capacity, rather than, you know, producing more, basically. So that is an area of further research, I would say, and a key barrier to circular economy approaches.
Well, finally, Anupam, you talk about the circular economy approach as being a kind of a no regrets strategy for governments to adopt. So could we perhaps end up by you giving us a bit of a summary as to what you mean by this in the context of decarbonization in the circular economy?
Sure, David. So very quickly, no-regret strategies generally refer to policy actions which are specific to addressing a particular problem, which makes sense in developmental terms, regardless of whether the problem materializes in the future. And this essentially is achieved by building resilience in the system. And in the paper, we argue that circular economy approaches should be an integrated and inherent part of existing decarbonization policy instruments because of all the benefits that they bring. But beyond that, the original underpinning objective of circular economy approaches has been to improve efficiency and allocative and technical efficiency. So in the paper, we argue that even, let's say, we conceive of a world in the future which is fully decarbonized, circular economy approaches will continue to be relevant because they would then go back to fulfilling their traditional so-called function of improving efficiency. So that ultimately makes the adoption of circular economy policies a no-regret strategy for governments.
Anna Palmer Carlo, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation that built on the recent publication, Beyond Energy, Incentivizing Decarbonization Through the Circular Economy. That was published on the 1st of April 2021 by the Institute. I hope all of you have enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.